Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, I could easily get sucked into the I'll call it the porn cycle for the national news, the international news, and so forth. But I think it's really more important that we just kind of wrap up this content, cover the election stuff, because I think that's one of the things that is absolutely gripping people. And then once we get the content covered, then we can kind of get, well, there's going to be more content, folks. We will, you know, cover the other historical or the highly important historical points, like the Whiskey Rebellion, the Assumption Act, all of those types of things, of what the federal government did, what they should have done, what they didn't do, and so forth. So you can actually understand how the framers, when they started driving this constitutional government down the road, you know, exactly how well they adhered to it and how easily it would be to get back to that. But without any further ado, I'd like to bring Paul back in, because we're still going through the Virginia ratification debates. And are you with us, Paul?
Paul is here. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. I'm doing excellent. And so, you know, before we move forward, are there any, I call it saved rounds, any residual questions or issues or anything?
I don't have any at the moment.
Okay, great.
It's been a busy day for both of us, and I think we just...
All right.
I didn't take notes, so let's just move on.
Okay, so we're kind of covering the last comment by George Mason on the 16th of June, and this is where he kind of talks a little bit about the 10th Amendment, if I remember correctly. So go ahead and let's kick it off there.
All right. I think this is about jurisdiction, correct?
Actually, so, you'll read it and you'll understand that it has more to do with the 10th Amendment. Go ahead.
Okay. Many gentlemen whom I respect take different sides of this question. We wish this amendment to be introduced to remove our apprehensions. There was a clause in the Confederation reserving to the states respectively every power, jurisdiction, and right not expressly delegated to the United States. This clause has never been complained of, but approved by all. Why not, then, have a similar clause in this Constitution, in which it is the more indispensably necessary than in the Confederation because of the great augmentation of power vested in the former? In my humble apprehension, unless there be some such clear and finite expression, this clause now under consideration will go to anything our rulers may think proper, unless there be some express declaration that everything not given is retained, it will be carried to any power Congress may please.
Well, so technically, what Mason is asserting at the very end here, that they may think anything proper. Well, actually, no, because it's been told and stated time and time again that the Constitution has very specific enumerated powers, enumerated roles, and so forth. And those things not enumerated are unconstitutional, or they have no authority to do it. They can't meddle with it.
Right.
Right. So, in other words, and I've said this before, when you read the Anti-Federalist, even though he does make a good point that it would be good just to have this declaration, he makes an assertion that they'll be able to just, you know, at their discretion, choose to do whatever they want. But in doing so, they would be violating those very few and defined enumerated powers and exercising a power not delegated, period.
Right.
Okay. All right. So then, all of a sudden, Henry just steps in, and it's interestingly enough, this is one of the shortest lines we have with Henry, where he said he moved to read the 8th to the 13th article of the Declaration of Rights, which was then done. And so,
right.
And the Declaration of Rights, I think, was out of the Glorious Bill of Rights. At that point in
Are you
time?
talking about the British Bill of Rights?
Yes.
That may be.
Yeah, because at this point in time, they didn't even establish a Bill of Rights, unless they're talking about the Declaration of Rights of Virginia, which they don't really reference here, but it doesn't matter. I mean, Henry just says, well, let's have this. And so they read it. And then George Nicholas is the next up in responding to the reading of the Declaration of Rights.
Okay.
Okay.
In reply to the gentleman opposed to the clause under debate, went over the same grounds and developed in the same principles which Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Madison had done. The opposers of the clause which gave the power of providing for the general welfare supposed its dangers to result from its connection with an extension of the powers granted in the other clauses. He endeavored to show the committee that it only empowered Congress to make such laws as would be necessary to enable them to pay the public debts and provide for the common defense, that this general welfare was united not to the general power of legislation, but to the particular power of laying and collecting taxes, imposts, and excises for the purpose of paying the debts and providing for the common defense. That is, that they could raise as much money as it would pay the debts and provide for the common defense in consequence of this power. The clause, which was effectively called the sweeping clause, contained no new grant of power. To illustrate this position, he observed that if it had been added at the end of every one of the enumerated powers instead of being inserted at the end of all, it would be obvious to anyone that it was no augmentation of power. If, for instance, at the end of the clause granting power to lay and collect taxes, it had been added that they should have power to make necessary and proper laws to lay and collect taxes, who could suspect it to be an addition of power? As it would grant no new power if inserted at the end of each clause, it could not when subjoined to the whole.
There you go. So the interesting thing is he actually makes an oblique approach. He makes a comment that there are no general powers granted.
Right.
And so even though they're talking about the preamble of Article 1, Section 8, which is the Congress shall have the power to lay duties, taxes, and so forth for the general defense and welfare, but must be uniform. So it was, all of that preamble was that they were going to have this power to lay taxes, and then this is what they were going to lay the taxes for the coining of money, for the calling forth the militia, establishing a navy, so forth and so on. And so, anyway,
Go ahead.
this, as we kind of look up above, this kind of points to why they wanted the 10th Amendment, because they wanted to make sure that those things not delegated are not granted and reserved to the states and the people, respectively. And so,
Right.
even though they just basically said that stuff doesn't exist, they moved forward without saying, yes, you're right, that we need to have that. No, they said, no, we don't need to have that. And they moved forward. And the bottom line is, and before we even get to the end of the ratification debates of Virginia, we all know that Virginia actually ratified the Constitution based on how the Federalist had stipulated and had defined the Constitution.
Right.
So, in other words, the necessity of all of these things was really negated, and just due to the fact that Madison, with the divine hand of providence, ended up giving us, because I don't know who would have given us, if you think about it, I don't know who would have given us the Bill of Rights 20, 30 years down the road. I don't even know if we could have even gotten the states to basically agree, because 20, 30 years down the road, we're, wrapping up Madison's, presidency, going into Monroe and so forth. And I just don't see the same character in some of the people, Jackson and so forth, because big government had already reared its head, and it had to basically go into the recesses, because of the Republican Party basically taking control of the government under Jefferson and Madison. And it was until after Madison where things started going sideways. And so,
so who started going sideways?
After Madison. Yeah, I mean, Monroe.
Oh, the government started going sideways.
Yes, absolutely.
Not Madison. Okay.
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so after Madison. So Monroe really, he was a huge benefactor of what Madison had laid out for him. And this is why he was really unattested as the for president of the United States in his second election, for his reelection. And that is when all of a sudden he went sideways. So because this is, you know, 2020 was, or 1820 was the year of his reelection, and it was also the year that things were beginning to happen, the Missouri Compromise and so forth, that took a little while because news didn't travel quickly. They didn't right. have, you know, CNN and Twitter, you know, that something could be actually, you know, go viral within a day easily. And so anyway, yeah, it took a long time for enough people to find out about it to where, you know, people started really questioning whether the government was going down the right path or not. Which kind of leads to John G. Jackson sending Madison a letter in 1821 saying, hey, we need you to release those notes on the Constitutional Convention, you know, his secret notes to say, you know, we to understand this Constitution. And Madison's reply was very straightforward. The only thing that they should be using is the ratification base, because he said it didn't matter what we thought. It only mattered what the states understood the Constitution to be at the time of ratification. So anyway.
Right.
Anyway.
And he didn't have his notes published until after he died.
Oh, yeah. Correct. And he was hoping that they would be a boon for Dolly Madison, and they weren't nearly what he thought they would have been. In other words, she didn't make that much money off of it, but it did help a little bit, so... Anyway, so the next one, Mr. Henry makes a comment regarding common law.
Okay.
And
what barriers?
Yep, there you go.
What barriers have you to oppose to this most strong, energetic government? To that government, you have nothing to oppose. All your defense is given up. This is a real, actual defect. It must strike the mind of every gentleman. When your government was first instituted in Virginia, we declared the common law of England to be enforced. That system of law, which has been admired and has protected us and our ancestors, is excluded by that system. Added to this, we adopted a Bill of Rights. Was he speaking of England? Adopted a Bill of Rights?
Yes.
Okay, added to this, we adopted a Bill of Rights. By this Constitution...
Oh, actually, hold on here. I believe he's talking about Virginia having a Bill of Rights because they had a convention for a Bill of Rights in 1783, or 1783, okay. Which was after the Articles of Confederation, Virginia stepped forward and added a Bill of Rights.
Okay, that clarifies it.
Okay.
By this Constitution, some of the best barriers of human rights are thrown away. Is there not an additional reason to have a Bill of Rights? By the ancient common law, the trial of all facts is decided by a jury of impartial men from the immediate vicinage. This paper speaks of different juries from the common law in criminal cases, and in civil controversies excludes trial by jury altogether. There is therefore more occasion for the supplementary check of a Bill of Rights now than then.
Right. Okay, so... As he states that when the state of Virginia was established, and every state in the Union except for New Amsterdam, because New Amsterdam was a Dutch colony, and it wasn't until it became New York where it actually then implemented common law. But okay. It did implement common law when it became a colony of England. And so all of the 13 states had implemented common law of England. And so Henry's just pointing out, because what's he saying here? What do we have to oppose this energetic government? And right. he clearly states that common law is the greatest device of opposing energetic government.
Well, the other thing he seems to be saying is that common law is assumed among the colonies, correct?
Yes, yes. So, but let's take a quick second and look at common law in England. The person, the individuals could call for common law and common law grand juries. It was a civil right. Now in America, because they needed common law to oppose the king, because they had no representatives. The king was the sovereign of all things. Even though they had parliament, parliament did not have that authority. So the people had the authority to place a check on the king's powers. And this is why Nicholas basically always stated that, when those checks would be placed upon the king's powers and they would invoke common law, the recurrence would always be, is the right, within the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, etc. If not, then this, the issue falls under the king's prerogative.
Okay.
But in Congress, it is absolutely the opposite. Are the powers delegated, or is the thing delegated to the government? If it is not, then they cannot meddle with it. So we didn't need a Bill of Rights to protect us. We had enumerated powers. And so even though they didn't implement, and I think somewhere they come along and say, hey, if we implement common law as the law of the land, then we take away the choice of the state to make its own self-determination. Unbeknownst to them, that in the Bill of Rights, Madison injects under cases of common law as a part of the rights to be protected. And so that means that as the 14th Amendment got passed, because you have to understand the Bill of Rights only really pertained to the federal government. It wasn't until the 14th right. Amendments where those rights were projected out to the states. So anyway, as we look at what he's talking about here, this common law to be invoked required, in a Republican form of government, required our representatives to take a stand as the opposer of our government. Instead of the people, when we cast off the monarchy and created a Republican form of government, then we had to give up more power to our representatives. So anyway, now, does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I see the question coming up from people who say, how do we get our representatives to act? And I know the answer you're going to tell me. How are we going to get our representatives to act when instead they become part of the government that opposes the people?
Well, so the people still have the right of First Amendment petitions to our representatives.
Correct.
And hold them accountable. And as a point in fact, when the consensus of the people is to truly hold them accountable to the letter of the law, then it's all done. I mean, either that person either acquiesces to the desires of the people, or they will elect somebody that will.
So I knew, I was pretty sure that would be your answer. And so the point that we're making is, one, the people are still in charge, but two, they have to use the power they have to stand up, to enforce the Constitution. Right?
Right.
The people have to use the power they have in the Constitution, particularly in First Amendment petition process, for example, to enforce the Constitution. So if the people want a common law grand jury and their representatives are not doing that, then the people can demand it through the First Amendment petition. That's where I'm going.
Right. Correct. You're right.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because I get questions. What about common law? Well, folks, you require it. Tell your representatives that this is the way we want to operate.
Yep.
And so I, okay, that's, yeah, you so, answered a question.
So complacency, complacency has been our, to our demise, but Henry's correct. Not finished. Henry actually adds something else. So in other words, we kind of, you know, he stops off with the Bill of Rights now, then, and then he re-picks up, or I highlight, a further point of Henry's.
I see it.
Okay, so okay. Go ahead and read this.
So, now. Right, I want to say complacency and ignorance are our undoing, but let me go on.
You're here. Absolutely okay. Correct. You're absolutely correct.
Is not this sufficient to alarm at men? How different is this from the immemorial practice of your British ancestors and your own? I need not tell you that, by the common law, a number of hundredors were required on a jury, and that afterwards it was sufficient if the jurors came from the same county. With less than this, the people of England have never been satisfied. That paper ought to have declared the common law in force. In this business of legislation, your members of Congress will lose the restriction of not imposing excessive fines, demanding excessive bail, and inflicting cruel and unusual punishments. These are prohibited by your Declaration of Rights. What has distinguished our ancestors? That they would not admit of tortures or cruel or barbarous punishment. But Congress may introduce the practice of the civil law in preference to that of the common law.
There you go. And so he kind of points out some of the things that government will do when they're not restricted by common law. Imposing excessive fines, demanding excessive bail, and inflicting cruel and unusual punishments. You see that happening today?
Sorry, sure I do. Of course I do.
Okay.
So at some point, the people can ask for the common law, but then they also recognize there is the civil law. And at some point, we probably ought to have a discussion about the real difference between the two. Because I think at this point, everyone's going to believe that we're living a civil law and that it's not serving us the way it should.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay, so... Let's see what Nicholas has to say. I mean, if you haven't noticed, Madison really lays out really good, succinct comments. But Nicholas really comes in and deals with some of the sophistry of the anti-federalists. So go ahead. Here you go.
Okay. But, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law is not declared to be in force?
No. You're missing something.
Okay, then I'm looking at George Nicholas. Yep. Oh, I am missing something.
Yeah, you're missing
something. Sorry
about
that.
That's okay.
All right. I saw the common law note. And I
You jumped right to it because you thought, right. Okay. Well, you know what? Okay. We have less than a minute left. And so, what he
for
wants to do is, we're going to go into a break. But what Nicholas actually does is he actually starts talking more about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the government itself. And then he goes into, this basic, defense that the federal government should not be dictating to states, how they choose to govern themselves. In other words, the destiny, their origins, their, how they want to create their own Republican form of government should be left to the states, not to the federal government. The federal government is only superior in those things delegated, that the states could have whatever form of government that they wanted as long as it be Republican in form. So here comes the music and the outbreak. So with that, Paul, we're going to be right back after this short break. It's obviously just a promo, but we'll get into, some of the limited powers and the importance of common law, or actually the importance of allowing states self-destiny. That's the key. And so we'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, you know, one of the things, before you dive into this, there are a lot of people, a lot of groups and organizations that have really made a big deal out of common law. Not that it shouldn't be a big deal, but there's a lot of misinformation regarding it, because they keep on basically portraying common law as it was under the monarchy, where the people could challenge everything. And because, bottom line, everything was challengeable. However, and as again, as basically Nicholas pointed out, the recurrence is always, is the right reserved? Well, in our Republican form of government, there are certain things that we really can't challenge, but you have to remember that there's this little amendment called the Ninth Amendment that basically is kind of like the catch-all, that you can, it cannot be construed that an enumerated power can supersede, you know, the rights of the people. So anyway, all right, so I'll let you go ahead and go, and we'll pick it up from where we were supposed to leave off in answer to the two gentlemen last up.
Yeah, Mr. George Nicholas, in answer to the two gentlemen last up, observed that though there was a Declaration of Rights in the government of Virginia, it was no conclusive reason that there should be one in this Constitution. For if it was necessary in the former, its omission in the latter could be no effect, defect. They ought therefore to prove that it was essentially necessary to be inserted in the Constitution of Virginia. There were five or six states in the Union which had no Bill of Rights separately and distinctly as such, but they annexed the substance of a Bill of Rights to their respective constitutions. These states, he further observed, were as free as this state, and their liberties as secure as ours. If so, gentlemen's arguments from the precedent were not good. In Virginia, all powers were given to the government without any exception. It was different in the general government, to which certain special powers were delegated for certain purposes. So, Jer, real quick, I wonder if he missed a word, because he said in Virginia, all powers were given to the government without any exception. Then he says it was different in the general government. I wonder if he meant in the previous sense, local government.
No, so in the general government, he's talking about the Confederacy.
Oh, okay. All right. You're right. That makes sense. To which certain special powers were delegated for certain purposes. That's correct. He asked, which was the more safe? Was it safer to grant general powers than certain limited powers? This much as to the theory, continued he. What is the practice of this invaluable government? Have your citizens been bound by it? They have not, sir. You have violated that maxim, quote, that no man shall be condemned without a fair trial, end quote. That man who was killed, not secundum artem, was deprived of his life without the benefit of law, and in express violation of this Declaration of Rights, which they confide in so much. But, sir, this Bill of Rights was no security. It is but a paper check. It has been violated in many other instances. Therefore, from theory and practice, it may be concluded that this government with special powers without any express exceptions is better than a government with general powers and special exceptions. But the practice of England is against us. The rights there reserved to the people are to limit and check the king's prerogative. It is easier to enumerate the exceptions to his prerogative than to mention all the cases to which it extends. Besides, these reservations being only formed in acts of the legislature may be altered by the representatives of the people when they think proper. No comparison can be made of this with the other governments he mentioned. There is no stipulation between the king and the people. The former is possessed of absolute, unlimited authority.
Now, he's saying that the king is basically vested with absolute, unlimited authority. The only thing that, you know, he has checks against him are the rights that are, you know, established in the Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta and so forth. So, anyway, now he jumps into the absolute of common law.
Right, and this is still George Nichols.
Yep, it sure is.
Okay. But, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law is not declared to be in force. Okay. Did I just read that?
Yeah, you did. Well, you started to try to read that, but you missed the first part. Now we're back to this. Yes. Go ahead and
Oh, okay, I remember.
Okay.
Okay. But, sir, this Constitution is defective because the common law is not declared to be in force. What would have been the consequence if it had? It would be immutable. But now it can be changed or modified as the legislative body may find necessary for the community.
Okay, so just hold on here.
Okay.
What did you just say? Read that last sentence.
Okay. But how...
Now it can be changed.
But now it can be changed or modified as the legislative body may find it necessary for the community.
Okay, so he just identified a stipulation. When a state declares common law or whatever law they declare, who has the authority to change it?
The legislature.
Not the Supreme Court. Not Congress. Not the president. The state legislature. Okay, keep going.
Yes, okay. But the common law is not excluded. There's nothing in that paper to warrant the assertion. As to the exclusion of a jury from a vicinage, he has mistaken the fact. The legislature may direct a jury to come from the vicinage, but the gentleman says that by this constitution, they have power to make laws to define crimes and prescribe punishments, and that consequently, we are not free from torture. Treason against the United States is defined in the constitution and the forfeiture limited to the life of the person attained. Congress have no power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. But they cannot define or prescribe. I'm sorry. Congress have power. I thought I said Congress have no power. Congress have power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. But they cannot define or prescribe the punishment of any other crime, whatever, without violating the Constitution.
Okay, so right here, very clearly stipulated, they have the power to determine kidnapping across state lines. Okay. They have the power to determine what drugs are legal and what drugs are illegal. Or am I reading that correctly?
You are not reading this correctly.
Okay. So they cannot define or prescribe the punishment of any other crime, like drugs, like kidnapping, right, like lying to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because isn't there this rule now that if you lie to Congress, you've violated the law?
Somehow.
Somehow, but it only says treason and these very particular crimes.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. If we had no security against torture but our Declaration of Rights, we might be tortured tomorrow. For it has been repeatedly infringed and discarded. A Bill of Rights is only an acknowledgement of the pre-existing claim to rights in the people. Mm-hmm. They belong to us as much as if they had been inserted in the Constitution. Okay, so what he's saying is, we don't need a Bill of Rights because our government is so delegated and enumerated that the rights, the people have the rights without a Bill of Rights, I think is what he is saying.
Well, yes. So in other words, it has to be enumerated for them to be able to do those types of torture and infringements of our rights and those types of things.
Okay.
And because it's not enumerated, they can't do it.
There's no authority to do it.
It's almost like sometimes when my wife and I read scriptures, we make a hand gesture for, something, and it came to pass or something like that, right? Something that they always say because, it's so repetitive that they say that we just use the hand gesture. Does that make sense? And in this particular case, this is one of the things that they kept on saying. They should have just created a hand gesture to go, it's only enumerated objects. If it's not enumerated, they can't do it. I mean, they kept repeating this. Okay, keep going.
Well, to our benefit, I would suppose.
Yes.
But it is said that if it be doubtful, the possibility of dispute.
Well, actually, you left off, I think. They belong to us as much as if were inserted.
They belong to us. Let's see. A Bill of Rights is only an acknowledgement of the pre-existing claim to rights in the people. They belong to us as much as if they had been inserted in the Constitution. But it is said that if it be doubtful, the possibility of dispute ought to be precluded. Admitting it was proper for the convention to have inserted a Bill of Rights, it is not proper here to propose it as the condition of our accession to the Union. Would you reject this government for its omission, dissolve the Union, and bring miseries on yourselves and posterity? I hope the gentleman does not oppose it on this ground solely. Is there another reason? He said that it is not only the general wish of this state, but all the states, to have a Bill of Rights. If it be so, where is the difficulty of having this done by way of subsequent amendment? We shall find the other states willing to accord with their own favorite wish. The gentleman last up says that the power of legislation includes everything. A general power of legislation does, but this is a special power of legislation. Therefore, it does not contain that plenitude of power which he imagines. They cannot legislate in any case, but those particularly enumerated. No gentleman who is a friend to the government ought to withhold his assent from it for this reason.
There you go. There's a lot of meat in this, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of very specific meat that you and I have been talking about regarding common law.
Okay.
And so here's the question. What state in the union today has actually legislated away common law?
Probably, I think, Louisiana.
Well, so Louisiana established
civil
law.
Did they legislate it away, or did they just...
When they came into the Union, they declared civil law to be the law of their land.
Okay.
Technically, because of the Bill of Rights, or I should say because of the 14th Amendment extending the Bill of Rights upon state legislatures, that technically Louisiana can no longer practice exclusive civil law. That the right of the people for trial by jury be extended, period. In other words, Louisiana has been getting away with, denying the people these essential rights.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm. So here's the question. All right. The people can do something about this. Right?
Yes. Yes, they can.
Okay. And they can determine that they want common law to be the law of Louisiana and use the First Amendment petition process to bring that about.
Right. And there's enough meat right here in these few passages where it was clearly declared that only the legislature can, legislate away common law. And because the state legislature has never done so, they've never amended their constitution to actually wipe out or, you know, eliminate common law as the law of the land, then the fact that the Supreme Court has done it, the state legislature should stand up and basically spank the Supreme Court for, you know, exercising authority and power and legislative powers that they don't possess.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So now we actually have Mr. Madison stand up, and he kind of talks about the exclusive legislation. But what, again, he starts this off like, you know, he's getting tired of them circling back around, making the same arguments when they've moved away from those things. And they we've settled this. We already discussed this. Go ahead. Yeah. So because
you missed it.
Go ahead. Who was it that actually brought this up? Was it Mr. Tyler or Mr. Mason? One of the two.
It was Tyler is the last person who spoke before Madison. I'm not sure. But here we go. Mr. Madison was surprised that any gentleman should return to the clauses which had already been discussed. He begged the gentleman to read the clauses which gave the power of exclusive legislation, and he might see that nothing could be done without the consent of the states. With respect to the supposed operation of what was denominated the sweeping clause, the gentleman, he said, was mistaken, for it only extended to the enumerated powers. Should Congress attempt to extend it to any power not enumerated, it would not be warranted by the clause. As to the restriction in the clause under consideration, it was a restraint on the exercise of a power expressly delegated to Congress, namely that of regulating commerce with foreign nations.
Yep. And it's interesting because that's the only thing that they had the nuances of regulating commerce. In other words, the next step in the Constitution was not regulating commerce within the states. It was regulating commerce among the states.
Okay.
In other words, making sure that states were playing fairly, that states weren't creating barriers against other states or taking advantage of port access over interior states that didn't have those port accesses. So, but it actually dealt with those types of things. And you can kind of see that in the Constitution, that the design was never to allow the federal government to dictate what a state was going to produce and what it couldn't produce. For that power to be, you know, assumed by the Department of Commerce, then that would require an amendment. But anyway, okay. So now George Nicholas kind of changes the subject. And this is because Mason earlier on, at the very beginning of the day, brought up slavery. And he brought up, you know, the evils of it and so forth. And then go ahead. Yeah. This is what he says.
All right. So Mr. George Nicholas wondered that gentlemen who are against slavery should be opposed to this clause, as after that period, the slave trade would be done away. He asked the gentlemen did not see the inconsistency of their arguments. They object, says he, to the Constitution because the slave trade is laid open for 20 odd years, and yet they tell you that at some latent operation of it, the slaves who are so now will be manumitted. At the same moment, it is opposed for being promotive and destructive of slavery. He contended that it was advantageous to Virginia that it should be in the power of Congress to prevent the importation of slaves for 20 years, as it would then...
After
20 years, as it would then put a period to the evil complained of. As the southern states would not confederate without this clause, he asked if gentlemen would rather dissolve the Confederacy than to suffer this temporary inconvenience, admitting it to be such. Virginia might continue the prohibition of such importation during the intermediate period and would be benefited by it, as a tax of $10 on each slave might be laid, of which she would receive a share. He endeavored to obviate the objection of gentlemen. that the restriction on Congress was a proof that they would have powers not given them by remarking that they would only have had a general superintendency of trade if the restriction had not been inserted. But the Southern states insisted on this exception to that general superintendency for 20 years. It could not therefore have been a power of implication, as the restriction was an exception from a delegated power. The taxes could not, as had been suggested, be laid up so high on Negroes as to amount to emancipation, because taxation and representation were fixed according to the census established in the Constitution. The exception of taxes from the uniformity annexed to duties and excises could not have the operation contended for by the gentlemen, because other clauses had clearly and positively fixed the census. Had taxes been uniform, it would have been universally objected to, for no one object could be selected without involving great inconveniences and depressions. But, says Mr. Nicholas, is it from the general government we are to fear emancipation? Gentlemen will recollect what I said in another house, and what other gentlemen have said, that advocated emancipation. Give me leave to say that clause is a great security for our slave tax. It can tell the committee that the people of our country are reduced to beggary by the taxes on Negroes. Had this Constitution been adopted, it would not have been the case. The taxes were laid on all our Negroes. By this system, two-fifths are exempted. He then added that he had not imagined gentlemen would support here what they had opposed in another place. Now, I had to confess to GR, this entire paragraph was a mouthful.
Uh-huh.
Probably a little challenging to follow.
Uh-huh. But okay. You could kind of see that there was a tax levied on the three-fifths of the slaves for representation.
Okay, so when you say a tax levied, now there was a tax on the importation of slaves.
Yes.
But in terms of representation, then three-fifths of a slave was considered for representation, which is...
Well, what he says here is, give me leave to say that clause is a great security for our slave tax, for the state slave tax. I can tell the committee that the people of our country, Virginia, are reduced to beggary by the taxes on Negroes. Had this Constitution been adopted, it would not have been the case. The taxes were laid on all our Negroes, but this system, two-fifths are exempted. He then added that he had not imagined gentlemen would support here what they opposed in another place.
Okay.
So I believe, and I honestly think you'd need to, you know, look at taxation and how taxes were applied. But it seems to me that because how did they vote in those days? Every state in the Union had a thing called poll taxes.
Yes, they had a poll tax.
Correct. And so I believe the poll tax was being applied for representation.
Correct.
That you had to basically account for your property and pay a property tax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, well, there's a lot of people that talk about. Now, see, here's the thing. You had a choice if you wanted to have say in your representative government, you paid your tax.
Right.
If not, then the government couldn't come and take away the taxes. In other words, you chose not to speak up in this election. The next election starts anew, and you pay a one-time poll tax to be able to speak. I don't think that they made retroactive. You owed for the last three elections. You only owe for this election. And so there was this it wasn't insidious, because if you couldn't pay your taxes, you couldn't vote. But
right. But
you weren't – because it was a tax to access your say in government. It wasn't a tax truly against your property like it is today, if you look at it.
Sure. So interesting, because a lot of people, I don't think I understood the poll tax until I started reading the ratification debates. Because it was, let me ask you a question. Is that how you determined that you were a property owner? If you were a property owner, your taxes affected your property. It affected your rights.
Only time you paid a tax on your property was at the poll tax, or at the poll.
Right.
In other words, when you went to vote, you had to have some cash in hand to be able to say, okay, I am going to exercise my right in voting, and here's my money for my taxes on my property. And in this case, in the southern states where they had slaves, sure seems to me that there was a levied tax on the 2/5 of slaves.
Okay, now that's getting more interesting. Let me see if I understand. So it wasn't a fixed amount of tax. It was actually laid on the value of their property. Is that right? Because if that's the case, slaveholders paid more in their poll tax
because they had more property. Because 2/5 of the slave was considered property. That's what it says, the very last two sentences, or three sentences. The taxes were laid on all Negroes. In other words, in the old system, the taxes were laid on all Negroes. By this system, 2/5 are exempted. He then added that had he not imagined gentlemen would support here what they had opposed in another place. In other words, they were complaining probably that they were had to play, previously they had to pay a full tax on the Negroes or on their slaves.
Oh, okay. And now, only was there an importation tax, there was a poll tax.
Yes, there was a poll tax. And the poll tax was on your property. And at that point in time, slaves were property, just like everything else that they could account for. And I'm sure that they had, some accounting. And when I look at how much it was, because there were so many people that were voting, I don't think the taxes were that high. I think maybe a tenth of a penny allocated for a certain quantity or something like that. So anyway, it sounds like you just went away. Are you back?
Oh, I'm here. Didn't go away.
Okay. All right, so anyway, we can move forward, because then Madison talks about, hold on here, we're actually at the end. So when we come back, folks, on Tuesday next week, Paul and I will dive into Madison jumping into the importation of slaves and what he has to say about that clause. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.